A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on November 14, 1993, entitled, "We Just Don't Get It." The scripture readings are Isaiah 49, verses 1 through 6, and Romans 3, verses 21 through 31. The texts for the sermon are Isaiah 49, verse 6, and Romans 3, verses 21 and 22. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
I had a little trouble with my throat at the first service. Thought we were going to have to cancel this, but you weren't so lucky. Might shorten it, though. That's a good thing, because the only person I'd be crowding on the end is me. I might just keep you all here for both hours. Let you get up and get a cup of coffee. Well, I don't know if there's anybody that's got more trouble than Senator Bob Packwood, do you? Quite a pack of trouble the boy's got. He acknowledged that there was probably some ground to his the charges of sexual harassment in the workplace. And it seems to me, didn't I see him stand up before the television cameras and say, "I just didn't get it"? I think he did. And subsequent events have proven that he still doesn't get it. I think I heard someone say that too. But that reminded me of the way God must feel most of the time as he observes us fumbling, stumbling, and mumbling along our way. I would imagine that God sits in the ethereal heights and sighs and says, "They just don't get it. They just don't get it. My desire that there might be one world and one people and one family and unity and shalom, finally. They just don't get it." Hans Kung said in a sermon and has written, I think, a statement that is profoundly true about our world. He said, "There'll be no peace among the nations until there is peace among the religions. And there'll be no peace among the religions until there is peace among the churches." Makes sense, doesn't it? Who will speak to the nations when the religions are over against each other? And who will speak to the religions when the churches are divided and over against each other? So, in our own mission statement, we have identified ourselves, or stated as our sense of identity, the fact that we want to be an ecumenical community and we want to be open to the dialogue with other faiths. I apologize for the fact that on the cover of your bulletin is the piece of the identity statement that I preached on 2 weeks ago. We did that for those of you that weren't able to be here then. So you can't read on the cover what I really want to address today, but it's those two middle paragraphs in that identity statement. Christ Community is an ecumenical community in background, in faith perspective, in worship expression, a blending of all the great Christian traditions. And then, Christ Community finds its window to God in the face of Jesus and affirms the quest and insight of other faiths, opening us to dialogue and mutual enrichment in our pluralistic world. We want to identify ourselves as an ecumenical community and as a community that is open to and respectful of the experience of other faiths. And in doing that, I think we will be doing what is necessary in our world today and be where the people of God ought to be. Because this isn't just an academic matter. This is not a speculative theological concern. This has to do with the well-being of the world. This has to do with peace among peoples and nations. This has to do with God's ultimate purpose for the whole created order. On the one hand, the ecumenical community, we've achieved that. Most of you have come since 1971, but in 1971, there were some of you here at the time, one Sunday night in June, when I simply preached a message about the reasonable and responsible nature of a name change. We were the first Reformed Church of Spring Lake for 101 years at that point, and I suggested that Sunday evening that it would be reasonable and responsible to change our name to Christ Community Church. Reasonable because in another generation, nobody was really going to care about the label on the door. And I'll tell you, folks, I don't know what you read in the religious press, but it's all over the place. Denominations are a thing of the past. Now, it takes, it'll take 100 years or so for them to recognize it. But as a matter of fact, those structures are outdated and anachronistic. And the label on the door doesn't matter to people. The Grand Rapids Press religious section yesterday had an article about the difficulty of small rural churches and the very fact that more and more people with their mobility are going where there is that which meets the needs of the people. And it doesn't really matter if it's Baptist or Methodist or Presbyterian or Roman Catholic. It doesn't really matter. And we saw that 20-some years ago. And so we called ourselves Christ Community in order that we might draw here a broad spectrum of Christian people from all the traditions. And as a matter of fact, Christ Community is a reality. That name gave us an identity into which we have lived. We are an ecumenical community. We come from every place. You can get here the old Reformation tradition. You're being subjected to it right now. I'm preaching. If you had come at 8:30, you could have come to the rail to take the Eucharist, the bread and the cup. We have some of the feel of the ancient Catholic Church, and we are perfectly welcome you to raise your hands and break out into tongues and say praise the Lord or whatever. We have become an ecumenical community that respects the respective experience of God in Jesus Christ. And I'm delighted about that. We also at that time said the future lies with a strong congregational base. And we have built here a center for creative Christian life and faith. And no matter where you turn today, it is this discussion of the mega church, the church that has the broad program, as Abel mentioned. It is the centers that are drawing in people and meeting a whole spectrum of human needs that are flourishing today. It is the wave of the future, and it is here. But you know, time moves on, and history moves on. And that second little paragraph also identifies us. And if we have already lived into the first, becoming an ecumenical community, we are only on the edge of growing into the second, and that is to open ourselves to dialogue with other faiths, to dialogue with the Jewish community, and for a growing understanding and knowledge of the Islamic community, and a recognition of that broad movement of the Spirit of God in the other face, the other religious experience of the world. 3 years ago, I addressed the subject in a sermon, and you didn't tar and feather me and send me out of town. I had just been to France in the cathedral at Chartres with those magnificent stained glass windows in the choir and in the chancel and in the transepts and in the sanctuary itself. magnificent stained glass windows that we were told in our lecture there were the community library of the day, the 11th century when it was built. People didn't read. They didn't have books. They came to the church and they saw the window and they learned the story. And depending before which window you were standing, you could read another story, Old Testament stories, New Testament stories, parables. There was Jesus. The magnificent rose windows, all of those windows in all of the various parts of the cathedral, all telling another story. But there was one common source of light. It was the light of the one sun that enlightens the world. That light filtered through all of the diversity. And that was the image that I used in order to suggest to you that there was a light that transcended our light, our particular tradition, our particular understanding of God, the God whom we see in the face of Jesus Christ. We will always have a window into the heart of God in the face of Jesus. But I think in our day we are coming to recognize that there is a broader spectrum of religious experience that we need to respect and from which we can also receive as well as share. A community that is open, that respects the religious experience of others who also trust in God and find their rest in that one who created heaven and earth and upholds all things by a word of power, and who is greater than our greatest conception. Let me tell you what to me is a fascinating tale. You know, these things don't just get born on Saturday night, but I have been messing around with these ideas for a long time. Way back in 1985, Nancy and I were in Hawaii, on the island of Maui, in the retreat of Robert Schuller and the Hour of Power. We were invited there as a part of a little theological colloquy. Nancy got the invitation. I got to come along as her spouse. Professor Berkoff was there, and Bob Schuller was there, and there were about a dozen of us there. And one who was invited was a conservative evangelical theologian named Clark Pinnock. Clark Pinnock is a professor in Canada. And during that week, we talked about the extent of God's grace. And we talked about the nature of God as that comes to expression in the gospel, and how some of us were having more and more difficulty with the idea of an eternal punishment in the light of the nature of the grace of God, the unconditional love of God that we saw in Jesus Christ. Well, we kind of took a poll. We went around at the end of the week, and Berkoff and I found that we were kind of out on a limb a little bit, because Clark Pinnock was not yet quite ready to shut down hell and put it out of business, and Schuller seemed to be on the edge, but he backed down a little bit. I think Arvella got to him. I'm not sure. But anyway, we sort of talked about it in a friendly kind of discussion. Then in 1988, 3 years later, I let all of that come to expression in an article which we published in Perspectives, The Habit of God's Heart, The Extent of God's Grace, The Possibility that God's Grace May Just Be Universal in Its Scope and Embrace. Well, that caused quite a protest. And as you know, there was a real controversy, and I stepped out of the seminary at the time. And we've got all kinds of correspondence. And there was a young man who wrote to me from Northwestern College. His name was John Stackhouse. I went to Northwestern at about that time as a part of a religious emphasis week or a spiritual week or something. I spoke to the students and I engaged the faculty in some discussion because this article was the hot item at the time. And this young man was very bright and very interested and very engaged. He wasn't ready to agree with me. He even published a letter to the editor in Perspectives, which called me into question a little bit, but in a very good dialogical way. Well, that was 88, and this is 93. And I picked up a September Christian Century, And here on the cover is John Stackhouse, author of an article, "Conservative Evangelicals Reconsider Their Relationship to World Religions." A review of two books, one of whom was written by Clark Pinnock, who had been on Maui in 85. Clark Pinnock has just published a book. You know what the title is? There's a wideness in God's mercy. There's a wideness in God's mercy. There's a wideness in God's mercy. And John Stackhouse gives a favorable review of this book, in which Clark Pinnock moves now from where he was in 85 to an inclusive position, where he too has shut down hell, at least as a place of eternal torment. Clark Pinnock from Maui moves, and John Stackhouse of Northwestern College reviews him with favor. I ought to go back and get my job. Well, it is really interesting, you see, to watch the discussion in the wider church. Because there is a recognition in our world that we don't live in splendid isolation from one another, because the world and its various faiths have come into close proximity within our neighborhoods, within our communities, within our nation. The world has become the size of a grapefruit. There is talk now of this superhighway of information, which would blow the mind if one understood the potential for the next year and the next decade in bringing this world together. The mass media, the mobility, the technology of our world says that we simply cannot live in a kind of triumphalistic arrogance that says we have the answer and all of the rest must come to us and be like us. It won't work. So I'm thinking, how in the world can I preach that? Because if I go to the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, there I have the Scripture of the people who were convinced that they had the true light of the one true God. I'm not going to find much there that's going to advocate dialogue in a pluralistic situation. If you read the Old Testament prophets, the whole world was going to flow to Mount Zion. Mount Zion would give light to the whole world, to the nations. And if you go to the New Testament, it's even got a narrower focus. It is Jesus. Jesus, the Christ, crucified, risen, coming. You're not going to find the Apostle Paul saying, why don't you sit down and dialogue with people on Mars Hill? He wants to convert them. God has acted in Jesus Christ. But I got to thinking, it suddenly hit me that my situation in addressing you is not so different from Paul's situation in addressing Israel in his day. You see, when Paul encountered that vision of Jesus, it's not as though Paul was moved from darkness to light. It's not as though he was moved from irreligion to religion. It was not as though he was moved from some kind of paganism to the God of Israel. Paul worshiped the God of Israel. Paul served the God of Israel. His was the covenant. His was the promise. His was the inheritance. He was a part of that whole scene. And was this the true God? It was. Was this true light? It was. Paul lived, served, worshiped God. And now he's got to say to his brothers and sisters who also live in that light, who are also the heirs of the promises, who also know the grace of God and the forgiveness of God, he's got to say to them, there's something more. They said, we don't need anything more. We've got Moses. We've got the prophets, we've got the law, we've got the Torah, we don't need anything more. He said, but now, Romans 3:21. He had been writing to the Gentile and then to the Jew, and then it takes all of them together, and he says, but now, two little three-letter words that say, hey, something's happened. Something's happened. And what you are and what you've been and what you believe isn't wrong. It's just so much bigger and better. But now God's way of making right, apart from the law, apart from all of the paraphernalia of that old covenant, but now, something new. Oh, he says, it's testified due by the law and the prophets. You see, he's got to do the same thing I'm trying to do. Somehow or other, you've got to justify that leap out into the abyss by finding some rootage back in the tradition. And Paul did the same thing. He said, but now God has a new way of righting wrong, testified to by law and prophets. I was thinking, where did the prophet speak of that? Well, obviously, the servant of Isaiah spoke of that. God says, it's not enough for you to call Jacob back home. I will make you a light to the nations. I will have you take my salvation to earth's farthest bounds. Paul says it's really there. It was latently there. It was incipiently there. It was always the intention that it be a global business. So, he has to convince people who are standing and living in the light that it's a brighter light than they have ever understood. And I was thinking, you know, if I preached that the way I preached it for 100 years, I would say, that's what Paul was trying to do, and what Paul meant was, now Jesus had come, and now that Jesus has come, the thing is over, the final word is done, now we just continue to hear that word of Paul that he was giving to the church at Rome, and we believe it like they believed it. And then I want to say, no, that's not really what's happening here. What's really happening here is that I have to do what Paul was doing. Paul was trying to figure it out. Go on and read the rest of Romans. He struggled with this. How in the world could his own flesh and blood, his brothers and sisters, miss the fact that the Spirit of God anointed Jesus? He didn't know. He couldn't figure it out. His heart was broken because they wouldn't believe him. But he knew God was nudging the whole thing ahead. And that's kind of what I want to suggest to you here. Maybe for a couple of thousand years we have been sitting complacently with the idea that the last word is spoken, and we have it. Thank you. And maybe when Jesus, filled with the Spirit of God, sought to bring about the renewal of the people of Israel, and was rejected, which eventuated in Paul failing to make that thing happen, going off in another direction. So now you've got a Christian church and an ongoing Jewish reality. But as I've said before, the paradox is that that Christian movement took the God of Israel and brought the God of Israel to the nations. Isn't that interesting? It's not Israel that brought Israel's God to the nations. It's the nations. It's the Christian movement that brought the God of Israel to the nations. And maybe at this hinge point in history, as this 20th century draws to its close and we stand on the threshold of the third millennium, just maybe the Spirit of God has been at work in broader strokes than we have ever dreamed of. Just maybe someone needs to say to the Christian church, you're not wrong. What you've believed is right. You're standing in the light. You're embraced by the grace of God. Your message is right. Your understanding of God is right in the face of Jesus Christ. But it's so much bigger. It is so much grander. I think Paul was so frustrated because he saw it so clearly. And those who stood with him in the light just didn't get it. And I wonder if God doesn't look at us and sigh and say, you just don't get it. I don't want you to be all divided and separated. I want you to come together. I wonder if 2,000 years down the pike, we can't look at all of that and see that the Spirit of God is moving across the landscape. And this, again, is not an academic matter. It's not something that's just a trivial pursuit of a few ivory tower theologians. This has to do with the safety of the world, the well-being of the world, the well-being of humankind. This has to do with living with grace and with love. This has to do with harmony and with peace. This has to do with the whole future. As you know, I was out in California a week ago, and I did preach at the chapel in the sky. I did my little thing about Peter and Cornelius and the new paradigm. And suggested to that diverse group of pastors from all kinds of mega churches across the country that Peter had changed his mind, and maybe we needed to change our mind, and maybe we needed to gather at one table together in spite of what our traditions said. Well, we made about 33 out of 35. But between the message and the Eucharist, a beautiful young Chinese girl, Jenny Lin Chung, 8th grade, just a beautiful young lady. She sang. She sang a song made famous by Winona Judd. Now, I didn't know who Winona Judd was, but I have since found out. Winona Judd is from Nashville. She sings. And her pastor, L.H. Hardwick, was there in the chapel from Nashville. Big charismatic operation. I mean, I preached to Bob Shuler, and I preached to charismatics and Black Baptists and a whole bunch. They were all there. L.H. Hardwick was there. Winona Judd's his parishioner. And this little Chinese girl doesn't know it, but she's going to sing Winona Judd's song. It was so moving. Love can build a bridge between your heart and mine. Love can build a bridge between your heart and mine. Don't you think it's time? Don't you think it's time? High time. High time.